The briefing today unplugs people's creativity by embracing the wonder of change. It seeks inspiration from maverick innovators and change makers to share their stories, experiences, and dreams. Paradigms are shifting. We cannot stress it more. Things are evolving for the good or for the bad. Currently, we don't know how things will unfold in the long terms. Too many uncertainties. Yet, we as a collective are required to engage in more sustainable and inclusive practices. When it comes to decision makings, we, however, are biased and decision makers can fall trap on them. I'm pleased to be here with Bettina Skudlarek to explore more of this matter. Bettina, as consultant for the United Nations Alliance of Civilizations and has extensive experience on sustainable and growth strategy. Welcome, Bettina. Thank you to be with me at the briefing today.
Welcome, Andrea. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. So let's delicately open the Pandora box of bias. This concept has strongly come back in the last years, very profoundly.
That is very much true. And I think it came back so strongly that many of us can't even hear about it any longer. So there is a big notion to actually change the language that we are using. And rather than talking about biases, talking about associations, some of those implicit associations that we might have around certain things around us, around people, around groups. So this is something that I'm very happy to talk about today.
That's a very interesting concept. So what you're saying is that we are detaching ourselves from using the word bias, and we are using more often the word association to describe a similar situations. How did that come? What are the reasons behind this shift?
I think in numerous corporate trainings, what we have noticed is that people do not like to be told that they are biased. They don't like to be told that they might be racist or have prejudices. And quite often, many of those biases are very subconscious. So we are not aware that they are happening. So there is no bad intent behind some of the thinking, and there is no awareness behind some of that. And therefore, depending which group of researchers you talk to, they actually talk about implicit association so that we don't put that heaviness of the word bias behind it that in some way suggests possibly a bad intent.
And you're actually talking about a negative layers surrounding the concept of bias. And I was reading in a book recently that actually we develop in our evolutionary process as a society, as a human beings, we develop bias to actually reduce our processing times of the many, many information that surround us, and by building those bias, which is, if you're thinking about system one and system two, system one is the quick one. We see something, we process that in our subconscious, and we already know, which decision to make it from there. So I was reading this book that actually bias and having those bias is a good thing for us. But as you mentioned, and as we've been speaking for those years, bias is something that carries a negative perspective on the conversation, and it's not actually positive to talk to that to people about being biased. So are actually bias as negative as we picture them, or is just the definition, the association that we put to that word that makes everyone, I'm not biased?
Look, as you said, we can't avoid the fact that we are thinking in shortcuts, and that we are putting things into certain boxes, objects, people, you name it. It's a very natural process, as you said. And it helps us. It reduces the complexity of the situation, of everything we experience. Our brain can't possibly effectively cope with every single new encounter as if it was absolutely new. So, for example, if we see a chair and we start wondering, is it a chair or is it a table or is it a cat or is it a dog? you know, our brain immediately, even though the chair we are seeing, we have never seen it before, our brain looks and very quickly makes those associations based on whatever we, you know, experienced previously and draws interpretation that in that moment makes sense and allows us to identify a chair as a chair. So there is, you know, a lot of benefit in effective thinking when it comes to those implicit associations. The problem is when it comes to people that quite often the boxes our brain creates for them and where we kind of put the new person we met, quite often we might put them in a box that has certain feeling associated with it. And that's how our association might be changing into a stereotype or a prejudice or a kind of negatively loaded bias. And that's the problem with those shortcuts we take when judging people.
So what could be a good way of, you know, unbiasing ourselves when we are judging people and capabilities of people and, you know, building positive association rather than negative, you know, outcomes?
This is, you know, a very good question and one that everyone is pondering upon, you know, all over the world. How do we make ourselves unbiased? I think the interesting thing, first of all, is that our brain really loves to learn. So our brain loves to learn about itself. So the more we reflect upon how we think and how our thinking process evolves, the greater control we have over how we are going to perceive the next person, the next situation, the next encounter. So there is a big power in really reflecting upon our own thinking process. So, you know, one of the examples which I always give when I, you know, train, you know, managers and leaders on biases, I tell them, imagine you're driving a car and someone next to you makes a mistake and you're passing by, you're looking to the side and you think, oh, of course, a woman driving. And there is always a big smile in the room because most of the people say, yep, I have been thinking that. And at the same time, when I say, well, how many of you have never made a mistake? Of course, everyone smiles as well, because whenever we make a mistake, we attribute it to certain situational circumstances. There is some urgency. There is certain reason why we are late or why we make a mistake in this situation. So we have excuses for ourselves, but our brain in that efficiency-seeking mode puts people into boxes. And the moment those boxes become, as I just gave you as an example, negative, that's where we need to, you know, overcome them. So the reflection on those moments, every time you put someone in a box and thinking, oh, what an interesting box. Where is it coming from? How accurate is it? This is the first, I think, important way to become more conscious and overcome some of the biases you and I or anyone else is having. I think another way when it comes to interaction with people is to really educate oneself about concepts such as privilege, discrimination, oppression, really understanding that we did not all have access to the same opportunities. We, depending where we were born and what our family situation was and what the, you know, political climate was, and so on and so forth, we would have access to very different resources. If you add on top of that, you know, the gender or the skin color or sexual orientation, the opportunities get smaller and smaller. And trying to understand that there is an element of hard work, but there is a big element of where you start that work, how much you already take for granted in your life that someone else cannot, is another way to overcome some of the biases. Yeah. Of course, you know, another wonderful way of trying to overcome bias is to find people who are different than yourself and really encourage them to give you the different perspective. This is especially important for leaders and especially important for innovation. If you put together, you know, five mini-me's in the room, five people who think exactly like me, they're going to end up with the very same solution to the problem given. But if you put five people with very different education, background, you know, cultural experiences and so on, they are likely to come up with very interesting, innovative solutions. So there is really this very purposeful effort that each and every one of us should make to actually surround ourselves with people who are totally different from ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're talking, and you know, you're touching two very important points there. And one I would like to talk about a little bit more later on, which is diversity and being able to suppress your decision making, which is, it's naturally going towards making a decision that is very likely to yourself. You know, that's that personality, it's mirroring yourself. So I would like to look into that a little bit later on our chat. But something that you touched before, you know, the experience, and we're talking about experiencing now, the experience of the driving cars, and you know, it is a woman instead, could be anyone that is driving the other cars. And that to me speaks about doing as many experiences as possible. So that comes to, you know, I've been quite lucky and that was also a decision I made when I was a little bit younger to travel and explore and see and live the world and live this diversity. So should leaders, before going to that position, you know, that they have authority on them, should they actually travel with a backpack and go and explore? So that actually is a natural, let's say, practice to learn how to unbias yourself to some extent. And that's my experience. So I don't want to sound too, you know, I have a solution, but I think, and I believe that's my hypothesis, that actually can help you out in making those experiences and see these differences. And of course, then we move into diversity, but yeah, what do you think about that?
That's a great point. And actually there is research around it, around the fact that, you know, the best way to become better at, for example, leadership, and especially, you know, global diverse context, is to, you know, immerse yourself in an environment that is very different to what's normally familiar to you. So we know that those kind of short-term experiential international assignments, when you just go and immerse yourself into a very different context, are some of the most powerful way to enhance your global leadership skills. So you are spot on, and we know about that. Some organizations very purposefully do that. So for example, a number of companies, they run the kind of young leadership programs where the graduates would be, for example, sent somewhere to Africa and put on projects with people from different countries, supporting some of the local communities and, for example, build local schools. So the whole idea is that you immerse yourself very different in a context very different from the one that you were brought up in, the one that you've been socialized in, and the one that you work, and learn to deal with people who are very different than yourselves, with situations which are very different. So, you know, I always love watching students of mine who go on a you know, big trips. Many of them do after they graduate, and some of them come back in, you know, as absolutely transitioned individuals wanting to change the world, that, you know, they kind of in some way find new missions, seeing how much richness there is when it comes to people across the world. So yeah, couldn't agree more. And you're spot on to, you know, something the businesses started to explore very purposefully.
So that's also, you know, make me think about another things that we build an educational system that if you don't do this in a sequential way, and what I mean by this is high school, university, bachelor, master, from master you might do another things, or you go into, you know, but you need to do this back to back, because if you take that gap here, you know, it sounds like, you're not a genius, you took a gap here. Instead, you know, and especially now that we are living in this context that, you know, the paradigms are shifting, you know, and that's how we title this conversation, you know, shifting paradigms. would be interesting actually to implement what you said into the recruitment process. You know, you finished the university, but your new and next employer must require you to do an exploration. Let's call it exploration before actually going to the job. That could be nice.
I think, you know, that's absolutely something that many employers look more favorably these days than they used to. But I also think that some of those transformative experiences that allow you to, you know, or help you to unbias yourself could be very local. So, you know, one of the initiatives that some of our students started, I think 3 years ago, was a support organizations for homeless people. And they basically just went out there. That was, you know, pre-COVID, when you could just go out there and support homeless people in all those different ways that they, you know, needed support with. And for them, again, for those young students coming from very privileged backgrounds, it was a very transformative jump into a world that they saw in the media, but in such a detached way that they could never relate. And that firsthand experience of seeing someone who possibly could have had the same futures as they have, but yet somewhere along the way made some decisions or you know, some circumstances became really unfortunate, that was a true eye-opener for so many of them. So I think that, you know, traveling will be increasingly more difficult for a number of reasons, as we see. But I think there are so many opportunities to challenge yourself and open up your mind locally. And I think that's what I would really encourage young people. And as you say, I think most employers, they don't want to see that you have your straight A's or whatever your system is giving you as a, you know, highest grade. Instead, they want you to be this, you know, well-rounded individual who has achieved something meaningful. Mm-hmm. And that meaningful can be in so many different domains. And this is something that we get, you know, back from employers over and over again, hearing that we don't care that much about the grades. We want to actually see in what meaningful way you engaged with the world in other ways while studying. And I think that's really, you know, refreshing.
Yeah, it's interesting that you are mentioning this, that you get a feedback from the employer saying that they're looking for this and not just for A's. However, it comes up a question again, is why in the position, you know, we don't have an answer now, but that would be interesting to actually pose this to the employers, that why in the job description there is not anything that it relates to what we're talking, you know. I mean, companies, if you're actually looking for that, they should actually proactively speaking to students, to young people, that sometimes they say, oh, I would love to do that, but I'm going to lose one month, 2 months on something that my employer, my future employers might not value. It's actually they are valuing that very, very importantly and very significantly, but it's not proactively shown that company is looking for people that have done those experiences. That those experiences build soft skills. You know, they're not building hard skills, but they're building soft skills. And research is so far showing that the next future of work, future of education is more about soft skills than hard skills. So it would be interesting to actually question those employers and say, why don't you proactively speak into to your next employees that they should do this, because that's, you know, that's what we stand for. That would be interesting.
I think, you know, my experience is, and you know, that might be different context where we, you know, you and I live. I think my experience that many of them do. So I feel like in some way your grades are the kind of base ground that you have to meet certain expectation. But then beyond that, beyond, you know, okay, you've been decent when it comes to your grades. I think employers very much already for a number of years are increasingly realizing what we are after is someone who put their energy and was thinking out of the box and was doing something more than just sitting with the books and studying. So we see, you know, increasingly with employers that this awareness is there, and the understanding and probably, you know, increasing knowledge of the fact that information can be very easily found online now. What can't be found is those skills, whether it's critical thinking, whether it's, you know, interpersonal capabilities. This is something that you can't learn from book, or not very easily, let's put it this way. So most of the employers that we talked to when we were recently redesigning our curriculum of the program I run, they said, we don't care what degree they come to you with, you know, when they finish their undergraduate studies. We don't care if they are law, business, arts. We want them to be able to stand on their feet and think independently. And that, you know, all the specific knowledge, all that expertise, we will teach them. This is easy. What we can't teach them quickly is the ability to think by themselves and critically analyze information and interact constructively with others. That's something where we would like your support. So I want to believe, based on my experience, that employers are getting very, very aware of that.
Yeah, that's good. Good to know. Good to know. And then come back, you know, we go back to the diversity aspect that we were talking before, and which is very important. And by doing this experience, you open up your understanding, you unbias yourself. And then when you become the leader, you know, that the person that has authority on who's to employ or not, which go through a HR process, and then becomes really important also to give your value to the people that are working for you and are in the HR department to make good decision on who to employ next.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I think, the research that I do is a lot about, in some way, diversity management and HR practices. And a big part of it is that, of course, we tend to be inclined to hire from the pool of people who seem to be familiar in some way. And again, as you mentioned before, it's a natural process. You know, the psychologists labeled it as homophily. We like people like ourselves. You know, when you enter a party and there is, you know, there are all the strangers and you make a joke and one person laughs and the rest is looking at you strangely, you will feel immediate connection with that one person who thinks you are funny. So we tend to very naturally, each and every one of us, be inclined to want to be surrounded with people who are similar to ourselves. And in HR, of course, the problem with that is that this is, you know, that is underlying all the challenges companies are facing with, you know, whether you call it a glass ceiling for women, a bamboo ceiling for, you know, Asian candidates, job candidates. There is always some kind of invisible barriers that prevent certain people from entering the workforce, because we naturally tend to attract and select individuals who resemble ourselves.
Yeah, and then we see nowadays that we don't have national borders anymore. I mean, I should correct myself that in this situation we have national borders because many are closed. But let's leave it there on the table for 1 second. But before COVID-19, we were seeing people migrating for good or for bad reasons. But some people are fleeing their country for war or for political reasons, or just because life there is no longer sustainable. Other people are migrating because they want to, you know, they desire to go here or there, you know, the well-known American dream, you know, that kind of understanding or desire to go in those big countries where research, innovation, everything's happening. But then when you get there, you might come from a developing country, you might come from a developed or developing country, but then when you get there, you are still an immigrant for that nation, for that state where you enter. And then you have also refugees that are trying to, you know, escape. I know you're an expert in this. What's the key learning? What are the things that we should actually use to make a more inclusive, a more resilient society or system, or just the organization? Because we can start in a small group, you know, the organization, and then enlarge it to the society.
Yeah, I think, you know, this links very nicely to what we discussed before in terms of, you know, biases and the fact that we like what's easy and familiar. You know, the research we have done, first of all, showed that those employers who haven't hired refugees before estimated that each and every potential challenge is going to be way more challenging than did the employers who actually did work with refugees. There wasn't one, you know, we had like 10 different, you know, categories of possible challenges, such as, you know, language proficiency or visa status, or you know, family situation, I don't know. Every single of those out of 10 were seen as way more challenging by those who have never hired a refugee and never had the experience, which tells us a lot about biases and tells us a lot about why refugees continue to struggle to find employment, because people operate on that, you know, very stereotypical assumption based of possibly no interaction with any refugee personally on an individual level themselves. So I think that, again, first of all, the awareness that possibly there could be a bias in my organization and I'm not lonely. Any organization, almost all of the organizations that never hired refugees will have the same bias. I think it's the nice opening moment. I think second of all, what's really interesting and also came from our research, because most of us have never met a refugee, it's the first time ever we meet someone, you know, when we hire them of that status. What we tend to do, and that's again where our brain goes, we create a new box, refugees. Now, if that first experience is positive, you know, people in that we interviewed, the employers whom we interviewed would say, oh yes, we hire refugees, they're amazing, wonderful, even if they hire only one. Because that one experience, our brain, you know, expands towards a whole social category of people. However, if that first experience wasn't great, and again, it could be just one person, the response was, oh no, yeah, we tried hire refugees and it didn't work for us, so we are not doing it again. And it was fascinating because I would say, I would be thinking to myself at that point, well, just because they are a refugee, they create a new box in your brain, you immediately assume several, whatever, you know, experience here to be really super positive for the whole group or super negative for the whole group. You would never say something like, oh yeah, you know, I hired a woman before and I would never do it again. So because it's such a new social category for us and a new box, it's very important that companies that do it well and that they invest slowly so that people can learn through the experience and can be really well prepared to accommodating someone for whom that transition, that, you know, refugee resettlement transition wasn't a voluntary move. They have never planned to, you know, migrate and be employees somewhere else. So they never strategize how to, you know, find a job, how to get to a job interview. Many of the recruitment processes in different countries will be very different to those that they might have done locally elsewhere. And, you know, some of the most kind of entertaining examples we had would be a refugee telling me, I think we were going to a training for preparing them, you know, refugees for a job interview. And the question that, you know, was asked was, well, if you were an animal, what animal would you be and why? And the refugee just looked saying, this is the silliest thing, you're joking, you know, why are you actually, you know, creating the situations when you are making a joke out of me? Because they could not imagine in the role they had, professional role in their country, that someone could ask for a kind of experimental psychological question about, if you were an animal, what animal would you be and why? So we see that some of those familiar processes could be really very alien to people who have been brought up and socialized in a different environment. So I think for employers, one of the things we see is really being, you know, opening their hearts and the possibility of hiring someone that's very new and creating that new social association, unconscious or conscious association, in a very careful way so that we avoid the kind of biases which, you know, are unavoidable in this context. Because many refugees, for example, might not be fluent in the language of the country they moved to, because again, they never have imagined in their lives that they would be today finding themselves in, you know, Italy, France, or the Netherlands. So accommodating for that and their circumstances, being open, from what we know with the employers who hired refugees, have resulted almost always in extremely beneficial outcomes for the company, for the teams in which refugees were hired, for the whole business. So there is a benefit to be taken out of engaging in refugee employment, definitely.
And by bringing some other perspective, you know, a new eyes into the team that you meet, you know, that inclusion, the diversity, and that's, I guess, how innovation can also spark, because at the same time, there are also some group dynamic that needs also to be unbiased in that way. But, you know, innovation can spark also from there, because they've been living in a different environment, so they might have solved that challenge in a different way. So that would be also interesting to see them into action then and see what they do.
Absolutely. Many employers said exactly what you are saying, which is we get such a fresh new perspective on everything we do that it's really, you know, surprising and refreshing. And again, it goes hand in hand. Good management will get the best out of people, anyone. So it's really about engaging with, you know, who you're working with and understanding their circumstances and their uniqueness in where they found themselves. And it's relevant as much as it is, as you know, for refugees, for any other individual that comes to work in the organization. That's how you get the harvest, the best out of people, by understanding everyone is different. Everyone responds differently. How can I have that strength mindset and seeing what is the best in you that I need to take to build my business? And, you know, if there are some shortcomings, how can we help, you know, you and us to overcome them so that we can harvest the strengths that we see?
Yeah, absolutely. So what are the tools or the method, the action that someone, you know, a leader, a manager is listening to you now? So what are the action that they can take immediate to, you know, to the immediate time frame that, you know, they can improve their HR system or their internal culture anyway? Because we are talking about culture here. We're not talking about, you know, just one department of the organization. We're talking about how the organization see those things. Yeah.
Now, very good question. And I'm saying there are plenty of things leaders can do. First of all, they should be the role models. They should be calling out bias, and their behavior will empower others and set the tone for the conversation around diversity in the organization. So that's first. You have to, you know, walk the talk. That's really important. Two, it's really including a diverse set of individuals in the decision making. Again, if you have, you know, a lot of yes sayers around you, people who always agree and never question you, there is a very little chance that you will really harvest the benefits of diversity. So you actively should seek out perspective those individuals who might be thinking differently than you. Think about how stereotype and prejudices and biases affect people around you. So actually see if possibly people limit themselves because they perceive themselves through the lens of a stereotype. You know, the psychologists call it stereotype threat. The whole idea that I'm getting inhibited because I think you perceive me through a stereotype based on the belonging identity of the group I belong to. So maybe, you know, as a woman, I'm not such a great driver and I get so stressed out sitting behind the steering wheel that I start making mistakes because the stress is overtaking. The adrenaline level, you know, kicks into the level that I'm, you know, starting to fail because I am continuously thinking about I am being judged here and now. And I think what comes back, brings us back to, you know, where you so beautifully diverted the conversation towards traveling, is to allow, create those collaborative moments that will encourage, you know, people to work with, you know, individuals different than themselves. So if you can't send them abroad, make sure that you get them to experiment in groups that are very diverse in different ways. And that's how people will have to force themselves to question some of those biases. And if you know that someone is in your team and they are amazing, but yet you think that they you know, work in a strange way because they work differently from you. If you have those evidence of performance and you are going to ask, you are being asked to work together, you will learn to overcome your biases because you know that you can, you know, you can get the most for the organization by making sure that you minimize the negative side of differences and maximize the positive side of it.
Wow, fantastic. Now, you, I think you gave a good list, grocery list for leaders to just check it off, all of them, and improve how they've been running all the HR and the culture internally. Also, now that we see a new way of working for refugees and for people that, you know, migrate, it's even harder to get to the first round of interviews, you know, or the first round of whatever methodology the company is using to employ people, because they might not even have internet access. So if we are looking at, you know, it feels like that the gap is actually broadening rather than reducing. And we are in 2020, we're going 2021 in 1 month. And technology is actually deprivating some people of possibilities. So even their organization should be proactive in some way to look for those people for a new perspective and be a more all-rounded company.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true that, you know, that goes for refugees, that goes for older people. Many of those, we also, again, have a lot of evidence from our research that those automated recruitment systems are very biased. They are biased towards, you know, technologically savvy individuals. They are not there to, you know, for everyone. So absolutely. You know, and again, companies that we work with that hire, you know, refugees in larger numbers, they have their own systems around recruitment because they know that those individuals might have not had, you know, the online application process system in their country. So they know that to get those, you know, great employees that they are trying to include, they need to be inclusive, starting from how they advertise, where they advertise, and how this whole process of applying for a job looks like.
Yeah, awesome. Now, thank you so much. Just last point. What is your last, or, you know, the current book that you are reading?
The current book that I'm reading? That's actually a very good question. And I'm not sure if I should, you know, be saying that, but I think there, you know, there is a use for that book in, you know, in other different contexts. And I very much use it in my leadership class. It's a book called Get Out of Your Head and Into Your Life. Don't ask me who the author is, but the whole idea behind the book is, and it's a psychology book, the whole idea is that a lot of what we experience in terms of negative emotions and you know, what can overtake our thinking in a negative way, it's really just what we create in our brains. So how can we free ourselves from that narrative that we create in our heads that then leads our lives and leads us throughout, you know, everything we do? And how can we just leave it behind and actually be in the moment and take the benefit of whatever is happening around us rather than living in our heads? So a book that I kind of, it's actually a workbook. So you can do, you know, a little bit of an exercise of what are those things that you might be overthinking. Again, could also very nicely lead to conversation on biases and overcoming them.
Absolutely. So thank you so much, Bettina, to be with me today. It's been a pleasure, a really fascinating and insightful conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Mattia. It was absolute pleasure. And again, I really look forward to hearing more leaders reflecting on all those issues, because I think it will increasingly become a very prominent issue if we are to build, you know, cohesive societies, because it's not just a business matter. It's a matter for us, you know, as communities living together.
Absolutely. I look forward as well to do that. Thank you so much again.
Thank you.
The briefing today unplugs people's creativity by embracing the wonder of change. It seeks inspiration from maverick innovators and change makers to share their stories, experiences, and dreams.